Hello. What did you have for breakfast today?
Milk and cereal, cereal and milk, cereal and milk.
Nuar Ahmed is a senior at Julia R. Masterman Middle and High School in Philadelphia. She's also with the Philadelphia Student Union, a youth-led group that fights for quality education in the city's public schools. Here at Making Contact, we asked Nuar to interview students, teachers, and counselors at her school.
What do you know about the budget cuts that are happening in Philadelphia?
We wanted to catch an inside glimpse of how they're dealing with the recent cutbacks to the Philadelphia School District's budget. In 2013, 23 schools were shut down, and over 3,700 teachers, counselors, and administrative staff were laid off.
My name is Mathafer Idris. I'm a senior at Julia R. Masterman High School.
So what are some things that are not present in your school that should be present in your school?
Compared to last year, we had just an abundance of paper. We kind of took it for granted. We had loose leaf at our disposal, and we could print any such thing or whatever we wanted to. But now, it's really scarce, and teachers treat it like it's very special.
Advocates say that what's happening at Masterman High School and in Philadelphia in general is one more example of how public schools across the country are being shut down to make way for more lucrative ventures, like charter or private schools. It's part of a larger process that some call education reform. Others call it the privatization of public education. In the end, advocates say, the shift has left the most vulnerable students, students of color and those from low-income families, sitting in overcrowded and understaffed schools. On this edition of Making Contact, we'll explore how the privatization of public education is playing out across the country, and how students and teachers are fighting back. We'll go to California, where community colleges are under threat. We'll hear about Teach for America, and how sending thousands of young, intelligent, idealistic teachers into classrooms may be doing more harm than good. But first, let's return to Nuar Ahmed in Philadelphia and see how her classmates and teachers are surviving the daily grind.
So what kinds of things that you thought would be present in schools aren't present now?
Well, we recently renovated our library, but we didn't have money for a librarian, so it was kind of pointless because we couldn't take out books. My name is Joanna Jang. I'm in ninth grade, and I go to Masterman.
My name is Arnell Downing. I'm a senior at Masterman High School. I was going to take AP Calculus BC, but there wasn't enough money to have the class, and that affects me getting into a better college.
I do cross country, and we have to buy our own uniforms, and for some meets we have to pay the entry ourselves. My name's Wyatt St. Clair. I'm a junior.
Listening to these students talk, you wouldn't know that their school is actually faring way better than most.
Down the street at Ben Franklin High School, one of my friends is in a class with 60 other people, so it's very hard for the teachers.
Masterman receives the same amount of funding as other schools in the district. The difference is, it sits in a well-off neighborhood and has the highest academic ranking in the state. While most schools have no guidance counselors, no aides, no secretaries, no assistant principals, basically no support staff, at Masterman, parents are filling these roles on a volunteer basis. But despite these advantages, teachers and counselors at Masterman are still struggling.
My name is Liz Taylor. I teach 9th grade, 10th grade, and 12th grade.
Okay, what exactly is your job as a teacher, and how have cutbacks affected your ability to do that job?
I think my job as a teacher is to make sure that every student is succeeding to the ability that he or she is able. And I found this year challenging because I can't do as much as I used to.
My name is Heather Marcus. I'm a school counselor at Masterman for students in grades 5 through 12. We went from having 5 counselors at one point for 1,200 students to only 2 counselors this year. When you think about meeting the needs of 600 students, sometimes you feel like you're putting out fires and handling the most important issues that have to be handled. But there are other students who need assistance too, and their needs are just as important, but there's not enough time in the day. So it's frustrating and upsetting.
What are teachers and students and parents and community members all doing to fight back or create better opportunities for these students?
I feel like there are definitely a number of people in Philadelphia who are stepping up and not just quietly accepting the cuts.
I've been very active for about the last year.
I've also helped organize rallies at the school district.
I've spoken to city council. I've written letters to the editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer.
I just wanted to mention about the council group that we formed, Philly School Counselors United. We have meetings on our own time after school to support one another, to share resources.
I've had meetings with councilmen.
I've also reached out to other representatives who do not represent Philadelphia because I think they're the key to this puzzle.
We have another group that's been working with Representative Brendan Boyle, and he is working on getting a law passed in Pennsylvania to make school counselors mandatory in elementary schools, middle schools, and high schools.
Also gone to as many political events as I can, and I don't know what else we can really do.
Yeah.
One target of the blame for what's happening is Pennsylvania's governor. Tom Corbett came into office in 2011, expressing his support for private and charter schools, but highly critical of funding public schools. He cut spending on education while funneling $400 million to the construction of a large prison.
Now, if you guys could tell the governor one thing, what would it be?
He's done a lot to hurt us and to hurt our education and ultimately our future. There's no way I'm voting for him in this next election.
He should be more considerate for putting in more money for education because it's important.
I would tell Governor Corbett that investing smartly is investing in the future. And if you invest in students, you're investing for a good future. And if you're not doing that, you're making a bad business decision.
We'd like to thank Nuar Ahmed from Philadelphia Student Union for those interviews. At the same time that Philadelphia schools are facing budget cuts and teacher layoffs, a different group of teachers are actually being trained and hired. They're from Teach for America, a program that places young college grads in struggling public schools. In the last decade, students at reputable universities have signed up in droves. America's brightest students going into teaching? Sounds great, right? The problem is many have no intention of becoming a teacher beyond the program's 2-year commitment. And recently, critics, including alumni, say it sends them into the classroom unprepared, which in the long run damages the reputation of public schools. Andrew Stelzer has more about the storm brewing over Teach for America and why it's become part of the debate over public education.
My name is Joanne Tian, and I am a TFA alum.
Joanne Tian is from New York City. In 2009, she graduated from Pomona College in California, and like a lot of college students, she didn't know what to do with her life.
I heard about Teach for America through, they were recruiting very, very aggressively on my campus, and I'm not even sure how they got my email, but I got an email from them asking me to apply.
She got accepted into Teach for America quickly. She went to the 5-week training program and then was assigned to go to the tiny town of Tula, Mississippi. When she got there, the school's principal didn't quite know what to do with her.
Because she had already made the rosters without knowing that she was going to be getting these 2 TFA teachers. She just pulled 4 students out of every single 4th grade classroom, and that became our classroom. We created a demand as opposed to there already being a need.
Tian's experience being sent to a school which already had enough teachers is not very unusual, especially in the past decade.
I used to be in investment banking, so I think about this, you know, push to like grow your margins and grow your business. And I think TFA sees itself that way.
Soojin Jez, assistant professor at California State University in Sacramento, has been researching Teach for America's history, which goes back to 1990 when it was founded.
So before it was for districts that had staffing shortages. And today it sells itself as, you know, increasing the supply of teachers.
And this is where the argument against Teach for America begins. What used to be an organization whose mission was to provide quality education by filling the national teacher shortage is now displacing better qualified, more experienced teachers. Justin Fong, Vice President of Internal Communications with Teach for America, acknowledges there has been a recent shift to focus on growing the program itself.
Let's just say about 10, 11 years ago, there was a concerted effort to grow the size of the Corps and also grow where we were placing Corps members. And I think at the time, there were something around 18 or 20 regions. Now, that number is 48. So, you know, in a 10-year span, we're looking at, we've doubled, more than doubled the number of locales that we're in, and we've also tripled or more the number of incoming teachers.
For the 2013-14 school year, TFA placed 11,000 teachers in 35 states, and that exponential growth has come at a price. Professor Jez.
In many cases, school districts were laying off teachers, teachers who are fully credentialed and experienced, while bringing in brand new teachers.
So one example is Chicago. In the summer of 2013, more than 2,000 school teachers there were laid off. But the school district's contract with Teach for America actually increased. It went from $1.3 to $1.6 million. And they brought on 155 new TFA teachers. The data Jez has collected shows that more experienced teachers generally have a better impact on students, unsurprisingly. And it takes at least 4 or 5 years for Teach for America teachers to get up to par. But most never make it that far.
I don't think I wanted to continue anything with Teach for America after my second year.
Qian made it through the mandatory 2-year teaching commitment, and then she left. TFA's Fong says 60% of their teachers stay for a third year, and then the numbers continue to drop off. This is also where the problem lies, critics say. 2 years is just not enough.
TFA's 2-year commitment and very high attrition rates in their placements make it nearly impossible for communities to build a sustainable teaching force required for transformative change.
Carroll University professor Kerry Kretschmar did a stint at Teach for America back in 2004 in New York City. She's one of a growing number of former TFA teachers speaking out against the program.
It was very painful to come to the realization that despite the best of intentions and hard work, we were part of something that had a negative impact on students and communities.
Even those firmly opposed to Teach for America acknowledge the teachers have good intentions, but some think that in the long term, TFA bringing inexperienced teachers into schools decreases the quality of public education as a whole. And so as public schools get worse, this will only strengthen the arguments of those who want to defund public education and invest in private and charter schools.
KIPP Academy has been named the highest performing middle school in the entire Bronx.
Kretschmar says a prime example of the Teach for America charter school relationship is the Knowledge is Power program, abbreviated KIPP. It's a very prominent national network of charter schools in low-income, mostly minority neighborhoods.
KIPP was founded by TFA alumni, has a partnership with TFA. 50% of KIPP school leaders are TFA alumni, and 33% of KIPP staff nationwide.
I'm going to college.
Then there's post-Katrina New Orleans. After the storm in 2005, the chartering process was streamlined and the federal government spent almost $50 million to redevelop charter schools. 7,500 public school teachers were fired, while the number of TFA teachers tripled in size. They now have 370 teachers in the city, and 85% of New Orleans students are going to charter schools.
A lot of people, you know, tie the privatization argument to charter schools. I personally don't agree.
Teach for America's Justin Fong.
I think charter schools are public schools. They're publicly funded. You know, and I think for us at Teach for America, we're sector agnostic.
Teach for America has built a very powerful reputation. Their $300 million annual budget comes in large part from wealthy corporate donors, including the founding family of Walmart. Their influential alumni includes former D.C. schools chief Michelle Rhee, who now runs a nonprofit focused on ending teacher tenure. But increasingly, parents and educators are questioning the cost and effectiveness of TFA. There's a growing number of college professors who are refusing to write recommendations for their students that want to join Teach for America. In Pittsburgh, the school board rescinded a contract they had with Teach for America. Professor Jez.
The proof is in the fact that wealthy districts aren't clamoring for TFA teachers. Wealthy districts don't want newbie teachers who are trying to figure out what they're going to do with their life to teach their kids for a couple years before they go on to medical school or law school or whatever else. They want teachers with advanced degrees who have substantial experience teaching their students.
There's not a clear consensus among people who are opposed to Teach for America. Some people say get rid of the program altogether. Professor Jez says two things should change. First, bring in teachers to districts that do have a shortage, and second, increase the time commitment from 2 years to 5 years. Fong says Teach for America is listening to its critics. They've made an effort over the past few years to bring in more teachers of color. He also points out that TFA supplies far less than 1% of America's educators. So if the system is broken, it's not Teach for America's fault. Joanne Tien agrees, but says when a program like this gets so much attention, it takes away resources and energy towards finding different solutions to transforming education.
You know, we definitely want people to stay in teaching for a long time, but I think we also need teachers who are critical of the larger system.
Tien is now a long way from Mississippi. She's at the University of California at Berkeley at the Graduate School of Education.
Kind of my fundamental question coming into grad school is, what are the possibilities for education today? What would it look like to have an education that is liberating?
Ironically, Tien's following the path Teach for America says they want, for their alumni who don't stay in teaching to go into careers where they can tackle bigger picture problems in public schooling. Something to think about is, who's really going to end up changing education over the next few decades? The people who stay in the program and become long-term teachers, or those 28,000 high-achieving TFA alumni who are now wielding influence in business, finance, government, and elsewhere? For Making Contact, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. Because of generous support from listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the U.S., Canada, Australia, and South Africa. To find out how to donate, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. With elementary schools closing down and students going into lifelong debt just to attend a four-year university, it seems that the last outpost of real accessible public education is a community college. For decades, these institutions have served as stepping stones for students of all ages and income brackets that want a second chance. But in California, home to 112 community colleges, a surprising trend is taking place, one that is threatening precisely what makes community colleges unique: their accessibility to all students. In the summer of 2012, when teachers at City College of San Francisco found out their school was at risk of being shut down, they were
shocked. Like, what is going on?
It was such a shock. So we were so shocked when ACCJC said they were going to revoke our accreditation.
The news made major headlines locally. City College had been slapped with the show cause sanction by the Accrediting Commission for Community and Junior Colleges, or the ACCJC, which is one of seven accrediting agencies in the country. A show cause sanction is the last step before losing accreditation. And without accreditation, a community college can't receive federal or state funding, its courses aren't transferable to a four-year university, and its certificate programs don't count. For a school serving over 80,000 students and with the long-standing reputation of academic excellence, this threat was a first.
You know, I was unaware that an accrediting agency would put a college on such a severe sanction, even though the quality of their education was not in dispute.
That's Wendy Kaufman.
And I've been teaching engineering at City College for 30 years, actually almost 31 now.
Kaufman was on sabbatical and out of the country when she first heard the news.
But I started talking to some people, I started reading, and I realized that there is something very wrong.
And what worried Kaufman the most was this: what would happen to the tens of thousands of students who benefit from the many educational programs offered at the college?
Where are the formerly incarcerated going to go if they don't have the second chance program? Where are, you know, the poor people that can't afford to go to anywhere else other than a community college going to go?
After the sanction, enrollment fell by the hundreds. Students stopped showing up because they thought the school was closed or that their credits no longer counted. When Kaufman returned to teach in the spring of 2013, she joined Save CCSF, a coalition of students and teachers who've led protests and sit-ins and even filed a lawsuit in order to stop the ACCJC from revoking the school's accreditation.
In all my three decades here, you know, things, of course, changed somewhat, but nothing that ever made me pay so much attention, you know, nothing that really got me out of my classroom and got me involved in what's really going on at City College.
Let's back up a little to understand how City College got here in the first place. Every 6 years, the ACCJC sends a visiting team of outside administrators to evaluate each college in the state. Based on their evaluation, the ACCJC then determines whether to renew a college's accreditation. In 2012, the commission found too many flaws with the way City College was being operated, mostly having to do with its governance structure, its financial planning, and academic assessment. In all, the school had failed to comply with 14 of the ACCJC's 21 recommendations, plus four other requirements.
The school created 14 work groups to meet the 14 recommendations. The faculty worked extremely hard on their part of the recommendations, which was really only the SLOs.
SLOs, or student learning outcomes, are a way to rate the effectiveness of teaching in the classroom, and they are a key part of this story. Although student learning outcomes are believed to improve the quality of education, critics say they're more like standardized testing. They don't measure critical thinking skills and reduce learning to simple memorization. For a few years now, the Accrediting Commission has held student learning outcomes as the measure of academic success, so much so that if a college isn't documenting them properly, it runs the risk of being sanctioned.
The ACCJC has actually put 10 institutions on show cause.
Ron Galitolo is the chancellor for the San Mateo Community College District, which is a 30-minute drive south of San Francisco. For Galitolo, this issue isn't new. He's been closely following the actions of the ACCJC since 2006.
In 2006, two of our three colleges were sanctioned for I consider to be very minor departures. Many of them have to do with student learning outcomes, and I realized that that's when they really started sanctioning institutions. Let me just give you some data, more recently since 2000.
The numbers do paint a picture of an agency bent on reprimanding colleges. Since 2007, 71 of California's 112 community colleges were sanctioned by the ACCJC.
Or 63%. When you compare that to the national average, it's about 2%.
To put this into a broader perspective,
nationally, the ACCJC generated 89% of all sanctions from 2003 to 2008. So they're really kind of an outlier in how they're affecting these institutions.
And despite the pervasiveness of the problem, Galitolo has been one of the few college administrators willing to speak out publicly against the ACCJC. At a recent forum about the college accrediting process, he was the only chancellor among a group of students, teachers, union leaders, and state senators.
The only plausible explanation for City's massive enrollment decline is due to the severe, overzealous actions taken by the ACCJC. Simply, the punishment does not fit the crime.
Behind closed doors, I've had many of my colleagues say, you know, Ron, I agree with you, but you just have to understand where I am. A lot of chancellors don't want to get at odds with their boards. What I tell my colleagues is, unless we stand up and start saying enough is enough, this will continue to persist, and eventually all of us will be on sanction, and eventually all of us will be harmed irreparably.
A lot has happened at City College since a movement to save it from being closed began. After the 2012 sanction, a number of staff members were let go, and an interim administration was put in place. A special trustee was appointed to help the school meet the accrediting agency's recommendations. And to meet those demands, the school was forced to make drastic changes that many believe have impacted the school's ability to reach all students. The school's mission statement was changed to prioritize degree-seeking students over lifelong learners. Courses with less than 20 students have been cut. A new payment policy now requires that all students either pay for their registration up front or sign up for a payment plan, otherwise they get dropped from their classes. Meanwhile, teachers like Wendy Kaufman scrambled to document student learning outcomes.
So fast forward to April 2013, when the visiting team comes again to, you know, to see what the progress has been made. And the progress in terms of the SLOs, I mean, they were very positive about it. They actually even called the work a miracle.
But that June, teachers and students would be once again stumped. the ACCJC came back and announced that City College's accreditation would be terminated come June 2014 if the school didn't come into 100% compliance of all the recommendations, including SLOs. Barbara Bino, the president of the Accrediting Commission, refused my request for an interview to discuss these matters. But students and teachers have not been alone in calling the ACCJC's actions against City College unjust and punitive.
The Department of Education has reprimanded them. The state legislature is auditing them. Our city attorney is suing them. The California Federation of Teachers is suing them. So they're under a lot of scrutiny.
Leslie Simon has been teaching women's literature at City College for nearly 40 years.
We don't believe that what they did was in good faith.
And that is what's really at the heart of this story. Many teachers and students say the ACCJC sanctioned City College of San Francisco because the Accrediting Commission has a much broader agenda. Wendy Kaufman.
I don't think City College is going to lose the accreditation, and I don't think that it was ever the ultimate goal of the accrediting agency. I think the ultimate goal has always been to downsize us, which will shove a lot of students into either the private and online schools or relinquish them to not getting an education.
This would have been my third semester.
Itzel Calvo is 19 years old and she's undocumented.
Like I used to be a part of student council and now I'm not because I wasn't able to register.
Itzel started attending City College in spring 2013. Because of her undocumented status, she pays out-of-state tuition. That's $249 a unit, or five times what California residents pay. At the time, this was somewhat feasible for Itzel, who would take only a couple of courses a semester. But with the new payment policy, Itzel was unable to register. Even if she enrolled part-time, registration would cost her nearly $2,000 up front.
Like, my heart is at City College, and I feel that students should be able to come here. And so I'm really trying to organize, so I'm not giving up, like, on the struggle yet.
According to the latest figures, student enrollment has dropped by 27%. Many of those upset with the changes at City College say the school is well on its way to becoming a privatized institution. But from where he stands, Chancellor Ron Galitolo views the Accrediting Commission's actions in a different way.
If you ask them, I think they feel that what they're doing is right. And that's where I would fundamentally disagree with them. I do not think it's improving the quality of education. When you destroy the reputation of an institution, you're taking away its enrollment. When you take away its enrollment, you're taking away its resources. When you take away its resources, you take away its capacity to educate. When you take away its capacity to educate, then you see the spiraling downward effect and the failure from within.
That pretty much sums up what City College is going through. But in January of 2014, the school won a big victory. A superior court judge granted an injunction that essentially bars the ACCJC from terminating the school's accreditation until after a pending lawsuit against it is done. So for now, City College will remain open and accredited. In the meantime, activists like Wendy Kaufman and Itzel Calvo know that there's a long road ahead, and that much remains at stake for students who need City College to not only stay open, but also remain accessible to all. And that's it for this edition of Making Contact. For more information, check out our website, radioproject.org, to get a podcast, download past shows, or make a difference by supporting our work. Like Making Contact on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. I'm Nancy Lopez. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.